This is an ABC podcast.
Hi there, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. Great to be with you this week. I've been doing a little reminiscing about my childhood this week. Back when I was learning to play the piano, and there was one very tricky piece that I was having trouble with. It was a piece by Ravel, and it involved one particular chord that just seemed impossible to play unless you had at least 12 fingers on your right hand. And I came up with an ingenious solution to this problem that involved simply leaving out some of the notes. The chord still made perfect harmonic sense. It was a little less rich, but at least you could get your hand around it. And I remember my teacher said to me, "Well, that's fine. You can play it that way if you want to. But every time you do, you have to apologize to Ravel for disobeying his instructions." And I've been thinking about that conversation because my guest this week has been doing very interesting philosophical work on obedience, and not just obedience in the moral domain, but in the domain of classical music performance. His name is Glenn Pettigrove. He's Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Glasgow, but he's currently in Sydney, and I caught up with him this week. You've suggested, quite rightly, I think, that the concept of obedience doesn't necessarily sit well with 21st century Western sensibilities, and that many people today are more likely to approve of Henry David Thoreau's rather sceptical or at least heavily qualified idea of what obedience should be and the circumstances under which we should practice obedience. Thoreau, of course, was writing in the mid-19th century. What did he have to say about obedience and about disobedience?
So his thought was that I shouldn't be concerned so much with things like what the law tells me to do or what my boss tells me to do. My reason for doing what the law says or what my boss says isn't that they said it, but rather is that the law is telling me something that it's right to do, or my boss is telling me something that it's right to do. So I shouldn't give my customer fair change because the boss said I'm obliged to, but because giving the customer fair change is the right thing to do. He, of course, had in mind the context of American slavery and the tension around American slavery that was building in the 19th century, and he was putting this out in the context of an argument that it was problematic for me to contribute my taxes to an unjust government, that simply the fact that the government tells me to do something does not yet give me an overriding reason to do it. And in this context, my taxes might be used to continue to fund this unjust arrangement, and thus I should stop contributing to the injustice by discontinuing my payment of tax. And if that meant that I ended up needing to suffer the consequences of that because the law came around knocking on my door and wanted to take me off to court, then I should be ready to live with that.
So you've embarked on a very interesting investigation into whether or not we might go against the grain of Thoreau and consider obedience or a certain kind of obedient disposition as something intrinsically virtuous. And we're going to talk about this in the context of musical performance in a minute. But first, let's set things up by talking about some of the social roles in which we might find obedience to be appropriate or admirable in and of itself. What roles do you have in mind here, and how does obedience work within those roles?
Well, if we're likely to be sympathetic anywhere to the claim that a disposition to obey would be a good thing on the part of another person, it's probably going to be cases related to childhood that we think of first. So we think that children ought to be disposed to obey their parents, or that students ought to be disposed to obey their teachers. And we do this because we think, well, the child may not yet be ready to recognize what the situation demands of them or what's going to be safe in the situation, and the parents will. So the parents can step in and make sure the child continues to operate safely. And when it comes to education, similarly, maybe it's not safety that's our chief concern, unless it's a very practical kind of teaching that we're engaged in, but the child or student may not yet be in a position to see what the goods are in this space. And it will only be as a result of trusting the guidance of their teacher and following the guidance of their teacher that they will, over time, come to be in a position to recognize what the goods are in this domain and be able to see and respond to them for themselves. If we move outside of childhood, then one of the places that we might think a disposition to obey is going to be a good thing will be in the military. Mavericks may be entertaining in movies, but they really aren't entertaining in military organizations. And there we can see some of the same reasons might be operative. So concerns about safety might be relevant, and concerns about lack of full information might be relevant insofar as some of the information that a general has when making a call may be classified information that I won't have as a member of the enlisted. But there are other reasons that clearly come to bear when we think about military cases. Reasons having to do with efficiency of the organization. There can be not just too many cooks in a kitchen, but too many generals in the planning room, and having a structure in which every decision gets contested by everyone who might be affected by that decision will be remarkably inefficient, like unto a university, one might think. And so we want a structure that can make decisions more quickly than committees of the whole can make them. And having a social role in which one is disposed to obey because it's really urgent that this organization be able to make efficient decisions is the kind of thing that we're likely to be sympathetic to.
Okay, so we've got children, we've got students, we've got people in the military. Let's have a look at musicians. And here I guess we're talking about classical musicians or the kinds of musicians that play from a musical score, musicians that follow a conductor, that sort of thing. There's a certain line of argument that says that musicians absolutely should practice obedience. How does that argument typically go?
So the thought has been expressed by a number of people. But it roughly says that when you are playing a score, you should play it how it goes, or you should play it as it's written. The way that one philosopher of music has put it, he likens the score to a command, and the obligation of the performer is to obey the command. Similarly, the composer Igor Stravinsky suggested that the first sin against a piece was to depart from what is written. That's the worst thing a performer could do by his lights. And what one ought to do instead is follow what has been presented to you in the form of the score in order to play the piece properly.
Well, let's bring Henry David Thoreau back into the picture at this point and look at this idea of obedient musicianship with a kind of Thoreauvian skepticism. How might Thoreau challenge this notion that to depart from the score is a sin against the musical work?
So we might shift Thoreau's argument from political examples to a musical example by inviting us to think, well, it's not so much the score to which the performer ought to be responsive or obedient. Instead, it's, say, the beautiful that they ought to be attending to. And if they can see a way in which they might depart from the score and preserve or increase beauty in the performance, then that's what they ought to do.
So one of the most famous and controversial exemplars of creativity and novelty and innovation in classical music performance was the Canadian pianist Glenn Gould, who died in 1982, tragically young at the age of 55 and undisputedly a genius. But he was someone who divided audiences with what we might call a relaxed approach to musical obedience. What were his transgressions?
Chiefly, his transgressions consisted in changing the tempo. So he would take slow movements in Bach and he would speed them up, still playing all of the notes that were on the page, but playing them in a different fashion than the notation recommended. He might similarly change the volume of a passage from pianissimo to forte at certain moments, and again, in so doing, was departing from the notation.
Well, he certainly was a wonderful musician, and I think at this point we could say that Thoreau's argument for disobedience looks quite convincing, or at least attractive in the context of musical performance. Let's turn to some arguments in favour of obedience and see how they stack up. Now, you draw on the work of Thomas Aquinas here, the 13th century philosopher and theologian. He considered obedience to be a species of justice. What did he mean by that?
Aquinas conceives of justice as the virtue concerned with giving others their due. In this regard, he was following on in the tradition of Aristotle, as with so much of Aquinas' thinking about moral matters. And he thought that when thinking about justice, we might spin out different domains of justice, and sometimes we call those different domains by different names. What's distinctive about the domain of justice in which obedience arises is the relationship that exists between the two parties in question, between the one who's giving what is due and the one receiving what is due. And in particular, the relationship is one of superiority and inferiority. So when I am obeying, I am giving what is due to my superior.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week, Glenn Pettigrove, Chair of Moral Philosophy at the University of Glasgow and a recent visitor to Sydney where I caught up with him this week. We're talking about obedience. Aquinas also draws on Aristotle and his idea of virtue as occupying a sort of temperate middle ground between two extremes. How does Thomas Aquinas see this as being relevant to obedience?
This is perhaps the sloppiest passage in all of Aquinas' moral thought. It's a passage in which he tries to maintain this Aristotelian picture where all of the virtues are described as means between two extremes. So when thinking about courage, we can think about an extreme in relation to fear where one is too fearful. And at the other end of the scale, we could think of an insufficient degree of fear, too much confidence, say. And that, too, can be a problem. Courage is going to occupy this sweet spot between having too much fear and too little fear. And similarly, he says, with respect to temperance, which is the virtue that governs desire, we can have too much desire for a thing, let it run away with us, or we can have too little responsiveness to the goodness of a thing, fail to desire the desirable at all. But temperance is going to occupy this middle ground between too much and too little desire and too much of being controlled by one's desires or too little of responding to one's desires. When it comes to obedience, Aquinas makes a slippery move, suggesting that we can have a deficiency on the part of the person who is obedient, who is not sufficiently inclined to obey the orders of their superiors. Or, and then he changes the subject, we can have a deficiency on the part of the superior who gives commands and isn't prepared to receive obedience in the right degree. And so what he does instead of saying, well, I can be too inclined to obey or too little inclined to obey, he says, I can be too little inclined to obey, or somebody else could be too little inclined to receive my obedience. Because it seems he's not especially keen on the idea that someone might be too inclined to obey.
I mean, you're right. That is a terribly sloppy piece of reasoning. What do you think lies behind that? I mean, is it perhaps a disinclination on Aquinas' part to entertain this idea that somebody might be overly disposed to obey just simply because he really likes obedience as a man of God, a man who occupies this hierarchical worldview of inferiors and superiors? Do you think that's what's going on there?
I think it's probably influenced by the fact that he's a monastic who's living in the context of a society that is structured by the rule of Benedict that explicitly identifies obedience as an especially important trait. But he's also concerned that the right orientation on the part of a good person toward what God commands may be to follow God's command, even if that person doesn't understand what the directive is, and that my orientation toward the commands of a superior who might be a human superior are meant to be of a piece with my orientations toward the commands of the superior who is the divine superior.
So in a sense, he's like the anti-Thoreau. But if what we're looking for here then is an argument for obedience that establishes obedience just as a virtue in and of itself and appeals to a more modern secular sensibility, what might that look like and how might it be grounded?
So we're going to part ways with Aquinas regarding the view of superiors and inferiors that he endorses. We think the great chain of being is broken, in which some people naturally occupy a superior position and others naturally occupy an inferior position. So whatever our story about obedience might be, it has to be one that's comfortable in an egalitarian worldview. We're also going to be inclined to part ways, I suspect, with Aquinas on this idea that it's not possible to be too obedient. He describes a kind of obedience that he calls sufficient for salvation, which is the obedience that one offers in response to the command that is given me and in the degree that is warranted by the command. So if you're my teacher and you tell me, write a 5,000-word essay for my class, then I'm offering the obedience that is sufficient for salvation if I write a 5,000-word essay. And I'll be disobedient if I offer a 3,000-word essay or an 8,000-word essay. He also describes a kind of obedience that is an indiscriminate obedience, where I do what you command as my teacher, even when what you command is unlawful. So in addition to writing the 3,000 or 5,000 word essay, you also tell me to go rob the nearest bank. If I follow your directives there, I've not been sufficiently attentive to the domain of your authority. But then he describes what he calls perfect obedience, which is when you tell me to do something, it falls outside the domain of your authority, but it's not unlawful. And we're not likely to go with him in that conceptualization. We're likely to think, well, obedience should be rightly connected to the kind of authority that a figure has. So I want to suggest that we should rethink our concept of obedience, identifying obedience as a responsiveness to an authority within the domain of their authority, and in a way that is motivated by a recognition, not just of the goodness of what they tell us, but also partly motivated by our respect for the authority relation in question.
So what grounds for obedience pertain here?
I think some of the grounds that we saw in the context of children and military relations might be pertinent. So we might think about differences in degrees of knowledge or information. If you have expert knowledge in medicine, say, and I lack expert knowledge in medicine, and you, as my doctor, tell me that I should take the following medication for 10 days, then being properly disposed to your authority will involve my taking your guidance there. So that difference in information can come to bear in some cases. But in many cases, it won't be differences in information so much as differences that are rooted in efficiency. So organizing our shared social lives is a complicated thing. And we often will divide up the territory of responsibility, allowing one individual to specialize in one thing and another to specialize in another thing. You've got your patch and I've got my patch, and I should listen to you in your patch, and perhaps you should listen to me in my patch. So often it's going to be rooted in something like efficiency. But I want to suggest that there's another reason that might be in play. And we can see that if we reflect for a moment on what happens in the musical case. We clearly can have differences of information in the musical case. As a music learner, my teacher and conductor will know lots of things that I'm not yet in a position to know, and I should be disposed to follow the guidance of my teacher, even if I don't understand why she's telling me to do what she's told me to do. Similarly, there can be relations of efficiency, so that I've been given responsibility for playing the flute, and you've been given responsibility for playing percussion, and someone else has been given responsibility for organizing the tempo of our performance, and has been given responsibility for making certain interpretive decisions that we as an orchestra will enact in our performances, then we should be disposed to let our conductor do her job, rather than contesting every instruction and going off in our own direction if our judgment about the best way to play this bit of the piece on the flute or on percussion differs from hers. But there's another way in which we might end up with something that we're responding to, and that an orientation that looks like it might be called obedience might come to play in when thinking about these things, not merely in the context of a collective activity that needs to be managed efficiently, but when we think of it as a collective activity that's organized around certain goods that define our shared practice. So one of the goods that we as performers are committed to is the production of something beautiful. But another good that we might be committed to, say if we're an orchestra that specializes in playing period pieces on period-relevant instruments, is that we not only play the piece in a way that will be beautiful, but that we also use 17th century instruments to play this piece that was composed in the 17th century, so that our audiences can hear the piece as it was intended at the time of its writing. And that kind of orientation, an orientation built around the representation of a certain thing as good, the good of encountering period-relevant productions, is something that might define our shared activity. And so we might think of obedience as being responsive, not just to the efficiency-based reasons that come with us dividing up a shared task, but we might also think of it as responsive to certain kinds of goods that we're collectively in it together trying to realize, and that will be realized most adequately or in the way that we appreciate and have endorsed if we are responsive to the directives of a particular individual, be that individual the conductor or the composer.
What about obedience to a tradition? Because this is something that you've written about that really interests me, the sense in which the obedient musician obeys a tradition, and that this adequately grounds the virtue of obedience in music. And the thing that I wonder about this is, traditions, of course, are not static. Traditions are composed of norms that change over time. So what does it mean then when you say that musicians are or should be obedient to tradition?
So I think of traditions as practices, specifically shared activities that we collectively engage in with others, and as practices that are organized in response to certain shared goods. And those activities that are responsive to these shared goods are dynamic rather than static. So we don't just have a way that we do things now that is identical to the way that we've always done things. Instead, we have a way of doing things now that stands in a certain kind of respectful and historical relation to the way things have been done by us in the past, but that might nevertheless change over time. I think this plays out in a wide range of domains that we might describe as tradition governed, including in artistic communities. One way in which we might describe what goes on is the way that Alistair MacIntyre has described it. He thinks of traditions as ongoing arguments in which we agree about a bunch of things, but disagree about certain other things. And part of what goes on in those disagreements is a little contest for what we think it is we're committed to or should be committed to. And of course, musical performers, even musical performers in the classical tradition, are very aware of this and are engaged in interpretive enterprises that try and breathe life into the piece in interesting and novel ways. But part of what Gould was challenging was the parameters on that breathing life. But the idea that he's playing around with is an idea that his fellow performers, at least at some level or another, will agree with.
Yeah, very interesting. And I guess this helps to explain the reception of Glenn Gould within the tradition, because, you know, he's such an unorthodox figure, hardly a traditionalist in the everyday sense of the word, and yet he's absolutely central to contemporary classical music. So when you say that a tradition, or when Alistair MacIntyre says that a tradition is an argument, then with Glenn Gould, it's simply that the argument hasn't yet been settled. It's still very much in process.
Indeed. And it might be the case that one way for us to divide up the terrain is to stop thinking of classical music as a single tradition. Maybe there are multiple traditions. And in fact, the example I gave a moment ago of period instruments might illustrate that nicely. There are some musicians within the classical tradition who are committed to period instruments. There are other musicians in the classical tradition who are happy to play on the latest violin rather than on the violins that were available and that have managed to survive the 200 or 300 years since the piece was composed. And similarly, when we think about someone like Glenn Gould, we might see a different space in the tradition open up, or another tradition within the broad family that we call classical music, but that nevertheless is committed to slightly different ideals or goods, or committed to the same goods but gives them different priorities in their overall structure and behavior.
Glenn Pettigrove, Chair of Moral Philosophy at the University of Glasgow, and you can find more details on the Philosopher's Zone website. As always, there's an extensive back catalogue of Philosopher's Zone episodes, and you can find them via ABC Listen. I'm David Rutledge. It's been great to have your company this week, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.